Last time, our work was all on the blackboard. This time, it's going to be some collection of pretty pictures and only a little bit of blackboard stuff. I'm starting to talk about the applications of mean field theory. Tons of applications. For example, there are different kinds of fluids, and the different kinds of fluids have been more or less elucidated by mean field theory. These different kinds of fluids go under the name of liquid crystals. One kind of liquid crystal has the molecules lined up as shown here, but they have random positions. Another kind, called smectic, have the molecules lined up and they form layers. And a third kind has the molecules lined up and they form tilted layers. Another kind with the funny name micelle, you have a formation of tubes. This is a very considerable biological importance because these tubes serve as analogs to things that occur in biological cells. I've already mentioned to you, but I will go through it again. The electrodynamics of continuous media is essentially a mean field theory. E, D, B, and H are the fields you use in order to describe that electrodynamics of continuous media. In each case, one of the pair, E and D and B and H, one of those is the field produced by charges or currents outside the material, and the other is the result of adding the fields and currents within the material. Not the fluctuating fields and currents, but the average fields and currents, and that's why it's expressed as a mean field theory. This kind of mean field theory is usually very accurate. You and your textbooks probably never learned that it was an approximation. It is an approximation which is excellent because many electrons contribute to every bit of the mean field, and so the fluctuations are small. However, if you go to nanoscales, which is fashionable in both science and technology now, you find that this treatment begins to fail. As I told you last time, in 1937, Lev Landau put together a beautiful theory in which he described all the mean field theories in terms of an analysis in which he extremized the free energy as a function of the order parameter. Indeed, as a function of the order parameter as it might vary slowly in space. In different cases, of course, we have different order parameters. In the liquid crystals, the order parameters describe the ordering of the molecules. In the more ordinary fluids, the ordinary parameters, the density which jumps between the liquid and the vapor state. In the Ising model, the order parameter is the average magnetization. We know all that, I'm just reminding you. I will also tell you that the same approach involving mean fields is in very extensive use today. I put this together, well, you can see familiar names here. I put this together 2 years ago. If I look now, I would find more up-to-date paper than 2008, maybe with the same authors, with which I could pick out a formula in which there was a free energy, in which the free energy was extremized, and that serves as the basis of the calculation. This is how it is done. In fact, this is how it's done also in field theory. You express often the result by giving the vacuum energy, which is the analog of the free energy, as a function of the fields in the problem, and then calculating the equations for the fields by doing variational derivatives. This kind of approach was put together by my ex-teacher, Julian Schwinger. It has wonderful advantages. Let me read the slide because it states the advantages. The free energy could be expressed in terms of any descriptors of the system behavior. You don't have to pick the standard thermodynamic variables. The free energy is minimized by the correct, that is the equilibrium value, of any kind of descriptor. We've thus come loose from the particular thermodynamic variables handed to us by our forefathers, and we could use almost anything as a thermodynamic variable. The order parameter would be anything which might jump in the transition. In part, this came from the point of view of Landau. In part, it came from the point of view of Julian Schwinger. He was as a very young man, he worked on World War II radar. He used variational methods and effective fields, they're called lumped variables in electrical engineering, to build electromagnetic circuits. Landau and Schwinger are the guys who really pushed heavily this variational calculus point of view, and it developed in parallel to, and to some extent in competition with, a Feynman diagram point of view. So I remember that I left this in. I thought I pulled it out. I told you a little bit about Bardeen. Well, the Bardeen family goes way back in the Midwest. We are here in the Midwest. Midwestern Canada is rather developed the same time in more or less the same way as the Midwestern United States. The Midwestern United States had three families in which provided an aristocracy for the science in the 19th and the first three quarters of the 20th century in the Midwest. These families were the families of Bardeen, Slichter, and Van Vleck. John Bardeen's grandfather, I talked about John Bardeen, was the Charles Williams Bardeen, who served in the U.S. Civil War as a drummer boy and was said to be somewhat roguish. John himself was as far from being roguish as anybody I could imagine. Roguish. A bit of a joker, with lots of funny things to do, and not very serious. Okay, but that just gives me an end to talk about BCS theory again. The three guys who were involved were Bardeen, Schrieffer, whom I talked about a little bit, and Leon Cooper, who was a postdoc in the project. They put together a microscopic theory of superconductivity, but that's only a portion of the story. Another piece of the story is the property called superfluidity. That's an important property of superconductors and illustrates what you can get from a phase transition. If we put together a ring of superconducting metal, perhaps this is tin, and perhaps we go down to a temperature of 0.5 degrees Kelvin. We start out with a magnet in the middle of this ring. We pull the magnet out. That gets a current going. Typically, in a normal metal, or a tin, in fact, at higher temperatures, the current stops in 10 to the minus 14 seconds, some short period of time, which is not noticeable. In superconducting tin, however, tin becomes a superconductor at temperatures above this. This current persists. It goes around and around and around. It keeps on going around for times which we know to be of order 1 year, and perhaps is longer, expected to be longer if the wire is thick. So that there's a qualitative difference. Between the different phases of matter, or among the different phases of matter. not just the difference between densities, which may vary by a few percent or few or vary by a factor of two or three. Here we have a factor of at least 10 to the 21 between the amount of time a current flows in tin at higher temperatures and the amount that it flow the amount of time it flows at lower temperatures. It's tremendously important that there is a qualitative difference among different materials. I would be very embarrassed if the solid material I'm standing on were actually the qualitative properties of a liquid, in that the floor under me would flow away and I'd disappear into lower space. We make essential use of the fact that there is a qualitative difference. The world would be a boring place if there was not such a qualitative difference. Let's see what I said here. Blah, 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 blah. Tell you who did it. Point out that there are superconductors, that is, which carry a current like metallic tin, and there are also superfluids, in which the primary example is helium-4. And the superfluids are qualitatively similar, except that they don't have an electric charge. If you get superfluid into mo in motion in a geometry like this, it too will keep on going. Superfluid will, if you have some superfluid down here and you put it in a jar up here, it will rise up the walls of the jar, flow down here, drip down here, and gradually the beaker will empty out. This again is a qualitative difference between different kinds of fluids, different kinds of behavior, since your Coca-Cola will not do that. This difference, this qualitative difference among the different materials is reflected in the hydrodynamics, that is, the equations that describe the flow properties over long distances. This hydrodynamics is essential for understanding the environment around us, because the environment around us is made of long distances. For example, the flow of the fluid in this air is best described by what is called the Navier-Stokes equation, in which the velocity, that V of RT, is precisely the same velocity that appears in the local equilibrium solution of the Boltzmann equation. This velocity, which is just that, obeys a diffusion kind of law with a diffusivity, which is the viscosity. In contrast, if you have a low-temperature superfluid, you have a velocity which obeys a wave equation, and that, of course, is qualitatively different. And much of the properties of superfluids has to do with that qualitative difference. The qualitative difference is seen in the superconductors. I actually showed you this equation more or less already. The superconductor is described by a wave function, a psi of r and t, which is a wave function for stuff within the superconductor. What happens is, with a standard superconductor, we don't know what happens in what is called a high-temperature superconductor. But what happens in a standard superconductor is that pairs of electrons with opposite spin and opposite momentum pair up. Now, I do it by drawing my fingers together, but actually the pairs stand over a long distance with one another. These pairs all fall into the same quantum state. That's because a pair of electrons is a boson, and bosons can condense into one state. That state that they condense into has a wave function. That description of that wave function is due to Landau and Ginzburg. It was not in BCS. BCS didn't understand. The people that worked on BCS did not understand that. You start out with a free energy, just like the free energy I talked about in the basic Landau theory, except now psi is complex. If there's a vector potential in the problem, where you had P before H bar gradient over I, where you had momentum before, you have P minus a charge times A of RT. That charge is minus 2E because of you have two electrons forming the thing which is called the Cooper pair, and that's what forms the wave function. You then have can calculate the current, for example, as the derivative of the free energy with respect to the vector potential, and start to work going on from there to understand what's going on. Okay, that's the sort of the end of the story. Mean field theory defines for us literally dozens of different phases of matter. It used to be that every month you'd bump into a colleague who with great pride would say that he or she has discovered a new phase of matter, and they're right to be proud because every new phase of matter gives you a new qualitative behavior and a new possibility for technology. These phases are qualitatively different. I emphasize that. There's no such thing as a wave function, a single wave function describing normal tin. Normal tin is an ordinary metal. It is described by tons of different wave functions, which describe the different momentum states for the electrons in the metal, but there's no single wave function which determines what goes on. In superconducting tin, the transport properties, the properties of motion of things, is dominated by that single wave function, and everything is different. However, I can now prove for you what I call the extended singularity theorem, which is basically the statement that you can't have phase transitions, not in this real world. Let me describe it. I've described it to you. A bunch of you probably understand it already, but let me do it in some slight detail. I'm going to do it for the Ising model, because the Ising model is real simple. Question. Noise. No noise. No question. Just noise. Okay. So you get a sum over positions of the magnetic field at R times sigma R plus a sum over nearest neighbors coupling constant sigma R sigma S. And what you're calculating is the partition function, which is the sum over all of these sigmas of e to the minus beta H. It is now clearly true that Z is an analytic function of K and H for K, H on or very near the real axis. How do I prove that? Well, it's sort of obvious. One exponential, e to the k plus h, or e to the k minus h, or the sum of exponentials like that, they're analytic functions. They have the property that there are an infinite number of derivatives with respect to k or h. These derivatives exist and are finite. You also have the property that you can do analytic continuations. Along or near, I'm sorry, it's behind this a little bit, but I'll read it to you, the real lines. It says that you can do analytic continuations in these variables when these variables are on the real line or are near the real line. That means that not only for one value of k and h is this an analytic function in the neighborhood of the real axis, for all values of k and h, it is an analytic function. Analytic functions never show any qualitative change in their behavior. The thing is, analytic functions are always qualitatively the same over all finite values of their variables. A behavior like this, in which the magnetization goes to zero and stays zero, is an impossible behavior. A behavior in which you have an infinite slope of the magnetization at some critical point is an impossible behavior. This is an embarrassing fact. This fact is called, I call it, the extended singularity theorem. Since I don't know how to properly prove a theorem, somebody in the back of the room is likely to get up, as the people have at seminars, to say that this is not a theorem. Well, a theorem is something with a certain amount of, with a solid truth value. This has solid truth value. It is, there's nothing approximate or mistaken about it. This is a theorem which applies whenever we have a finite sum of exponentials. Anyone who does statistical mechanics would know this. Anyone with statistical mechanics and any flavor of mathematics, this would be obvious to them. It was probably obvious to J. Willard Gibbs in 1890. It would have been obvious. Well, Boltzmann didn't like to think in mathematical terms. It might not have been so obvious to Boltzmann, but it should have been obvious to Einstein, although probably it was not. This then leaves us with a dilemma, and I'm going to talk about that dilemma in a moment. Comment, questions?
Can't you go arbitrarily close to something that looks like that? And
the answer is going to be arbitrarily close. You're right. That is, you're pushing to the right direction for the answer. However, you have to have some a philosophical perspective is important. People like to believe that every concept in physics is reflected in an exact way in the real world. The real world, you're going to argue, contains systems which are very large, almost infinite, you're going to argue, and or then rather unlike finite systems, sort of. I'll make the point in more detail. However, the people's philosophical point of view is that they would like the real world to be real, and they would like it to be in physics. Now, I'm a little bit, if you could take a philosophical point of view, I'm a little bit with Plato. Plato said that what goes on in idealizations of the real world, well, he said that there was some projection on the wall of a cave. He was into TV before there was TV, but what appears in your mind is often an idealization of the real world, and this is important because it's the idealizations, in my view, that we use for physics. Well, I'm going to talk about that in a moment. I have to get my next excitement up. This particular version of the excitement, lights low. Nah, miles too far along. Let's go back to the beginning. You've seen this picture, but this picture is used in lots of colloquia and the like. What I'm giving you here is a slightly revised version of a talk I gave at the Dirac seminar at the Division of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge. It was an occasion celebrating the contributions of Dirac to physics. And so here we have a formal lecture. I'll get into real stuff a little bit, but I'm talking about the history of the renormalization group, but that's relevant for this. Historically, the renormalization group method, which we will talk about in the next couple of days, is rooted to the theory of phase transitions. Theoretical treatments of phase transitions are based upon mean field theories like the ones developed by van der Waals and Landau. Sharp phase transitions, this is the definition of a phase transition, and it goes back to J. Willard Gibbs. Sharp phase transitions are necessarily connected with singularities in statistical mechanics, which, here is your argument, which in turn require infinite systems for their realization. This result is called the extended singularity theorem. I'll talk to you about the 1937 meeting in Amsterdam in which this result was apparently first discussed in public. Mean field theories like van der Waals neither demand nor employ spatial infinities in their description of phase transitions. Another theory is required that weds a breaking of internal symmetries with a proper description of spatial infinities. Renormalization semigroup provides such a wedding. Its nature is described. The major ideas surrounding this point of view are described, including especially scaling and universality. Same stuff as we've been talking about, expressed slightly more formally. Forgot to take that out. Forget about who am I. This is also in part about the difference between condensed matter physics and particle physics. In condensed matter physics, we have clear formulations. We work with the Schrodinger equation. We work with statistical mechanics. Our goal is to explain the amazing variety of nature. Nature is sort of like an onion from our point of view, exposed layer after layer. We hope to see mathematical and conceptual beauty arise from the mundane. That mundane means of this world. Particle physics has simple results. Unlike the richness of condensed matter physics, in which there are literally hundreds of different experiments that you could visualize, particle physics basically measures only a few things. It measures cross sections, it measures gammas, that is widths, it measures decay probabilities, that's about it. Its goal is to seek a clear and final theoretical formulation based upon experiment and observation. Particle physics is always or often chasing after the final theory, the proper description of the world, of which physics will stop and we will go on to do something else. They, in particle physics, hopes to see the mundane arise from the mathematical beauty of a single truth. Condensed matter physics relates the observable, often macroscopic properties of liquids, gases, solids, and all everyday materials to more microscopic theories, often the quantum theory of atoms and molecules. Since the macroscopic theories are themselves non-trivial, that is, there are things like elasticity, hydrodynamics, the electrodynamics of materials, it follows that condensed matter physics is largely an exercise in connecting different kinds of theories. Typically, this connection involves different length scales. We go, for example, from the size of a molecule to the size of a laboratory. This you know about phases, and I'm not going to read it. Particle physics, not my field, so I'm doing what is called talking out of school, but nonetheless, I'll tell about it. Particle physics often wishes to relate its present phenomenological theory to a deeper theory at a much shorter or longer length scale. That is, for example, to connect the Standard Model to, as observed at the Large Hadron, connect the Standard Model to what you see at the Large Hadron Collider, or to the unification scale or the Planck scale. Up until recent years, the search for a final theory has been impeded by the ugliness of singularities arising at scales far from observations. These singularities show up directly as infinities in perturbation theory and indirectly as algebraic behavior, one over something or other, like distance, to the power p in a correlation function. Well, that's not correct. They don't call it correlation functions. They call them Green's functions or Schwinger functions. I'm going to follow condensed matter physics for the next part of the talk. Well, I'll do a little more. I'll do some more particle physics. Okay. Oh, why don't I put it up like this? Field theory and statistical mechanics are closely connected. We've talked about this recently. A Wick rotation in which you take time into I to O divided by Boltzmann constant times temperature will take you from one to the other. Quantum mechanics and classical mechanics are closely connected. Both employ Hamiltonians as the basic generators of time development, as do field theory and statistical mechanics. All four have a dual structure in which terms in the Hamiltonian both describe measurable quantities and equally generate changes in things. I remind you of this because it's important, and I wanted to say something else about it. You remember that the partial derivative with respect to t of most anything in mechanics is proportional to, I'll put a wiggle for proportionality, the bracket, bracket of x with the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian and the Poisson bracket serves as a generator of changes. The Hamiltonian is also something we want to measure. And so there is a dual structure in which what you want to measure and what generates changes are the same thing. That happens in Hamiltonian mechanics, in classical Hamiltonian mechanics, and in quantum mechanics. The only difference is what kind of bracket and the appearance of a factor like IH bar. This is an interesting fact because, for example, momentum generates motion in space. And there are other properties, all kinds of other properties, which you can stick in there. Let me stick in a something, an S, and that generates motion in something else. I write scale, but it doesn't matter what I'm really talking about. What is the important thing is that someone coming in from Mars and not looking at our world, but looking at our theory of the world, could not tell the difference between one kind of generator and another kind of generator. That means our Martian unobserver, our Martian student who never sees anything, our Martian observer might argue that anything at all, it has the same content as the coordinate x, and so might say that the dimension of the world is larger than the three dimensions that we're used to thinking about. Indeed, the way Hamiltonian mechanics is structured, the dimension is something which is up for grabs, which we can be talking about. And this is, in fact, a deep fact in modern quantum mechanics, both as used in condensed matter physics and also as used in particle physics. Okay, let's see what goes on next. Oh, what goes on next is I'm pointing out that what I said here, not what's on the board, but what I said here is basically comes from Dirac's work. Dirac worked at about the same time as Heisenberg, invented equally, sort of, matrix mechanics as Heisenberg, but Heisenberg was a little earlier. Okay, we've seen this picture before, and we're coming back now to our own business. Our own business is about phase transitions, and started in 1869 or so, when Andrews saw this picture, and Maxwell and van der Waals explained it. We jump forward now to 1937 again. It is ironical that the major things I'm going to be talking about, I have been talking about, was the culmination of the theory as put together by Landau and the weakness of the theory as evidenced here. We have the extended singularity theorem. Cramers was chairing a session at a conference in 1937 in Amsterdam. The conference was a celebration of van der Waals, 100th anniversary of van der Waals' birth. Cramers points out that for finite n, this picture is, that is, finite number of particles in the system, this picture is, strictly speaking, quite impossible. This behavior in which we have a sharp point here, or we have a singularity there, those things are impossible. They don't happen in any system with finite n. Cramers did not, I think, emphasize the words finite n, but they don't happen in the most ordinary statistical mechanics. The left-hand picture, which I am not sure you can see, because maybe it isn't up. Let me see if I can see that. Okay, I can't. Okay, the left-hand picture is van der Waals' picture. As you can very clearly see, what you have from van der Waals is cubic curves that look like this, but no jumps and no singularity anyplace. I hardly know what to say. I don't even know whether or not I'm embarrassed by the fact that it comes out on the back screen and not the front screen. Okay, but van der Waals' theory agrees with the extended singularity theorem, except that it doesn't have any singularities, and that is something that we can't live with, because we know that phase transitions exist and that they provide an important part of the world we see around us. The conference was perplexed. This conference was of the leading figures of the day, very intelligent human beings who understood reasonably well, who had been working in statistical mechanics and understood it as well as it was understood in the day, including such luminaries as Debye, Uhlenbeck, and Cramers himself. The conference was perplexed. It didn't know what to make of this point that Cramers made. It then decided that the appropriate approach to this problem, which it couldn't figure out what was going on, was to take a vote. Maybe this is a parody of democracy. Maybe it's the right thing to do. I don't know. It voted, however, on the proposition of whether statistical mechanics could describe the liquid region. This seems like like the wrong thing to do, but the liquid region was beyond this phase transition. And maybe because the phase transition wasn't described properly, the liquid region wouldn't be described properly. The outcome was 50-50, with Debye voting that the liquid region could not be described by statistical mechanics. This is certainly the wrong answer, at least in the context of the present beliefs. I show the present beliefs on the next slide. Okay, here is a picture. I'm sure it comes across more or less of the same thing. And now I'm going to talk about what we believe. Thermodynamic phase transitions involve singularities and infinities arising almost always from the unbounded number of particles in the system. That is, you need an infinite number of particles in the system to get a sharp corner here, to get infinities there. These infinities appear in thermodynamic derivatives. They are caused by a coherence length, a correlation length, that diverges as the critical point is approached. Diverges there. I didn't say that there was a diverging correlation length there, because there isn't. And excuse me? The story is a little more complicated. That is, the diverging correlation length doesn't exactly occur in the liquid region. What happens is you get into the boiling region. As soon as you get into the boiling region, you get real big drops. So right here, there's an infinite correlation length. You just look at it. You boil a pot of water in the morning, and you get drops of huge size in that. So here, there's an infinite correlation length. There, no way. That is confusing, and confused me for a long time when I thought about this. So, but you do have an infinite correlation length, and there's some stuff more on that, on this slide about that. So up here you get an infinite correlation length. There you don't. There you do. Whenever you have a mixture of vapor and of liquid as of the equilibrium state, you have large correlations. In practice, the coherence length describes the spatial extent of fluctuations, which, and they look like regions of two phases intermixed. This divergence that comes from infinite correlation lengths and the appearance or the actuality, appearance here and actuality there of two phases mixed, makes for the makes the extended singularity theorem correct. The conference was right. The application of statistical mechanics fails, but not here, nor there, which they thought it might. But it fails, or rather we don't use it because it's a mess, in the region in which there is liquid and vapor intermixed. In that region, tiny little details like the dynamics of the material, the surface tension, the existence of gravity, things that normally aren't important, start to become important, and we just problem gets too complicated, and we simply don't use statistical mechanics much to describe it. However, what we see is that the mean field theory makes no reference to a system which is finite or infinite. The mean field theory of the Isaac model that I gave you talked about particles which were next door to one another. I'm going to talk more about that. But the mean field theory doesn't require an infinite system. The theories available in 1937 all failed to meet this criterion that they have phase transitions only in an infinite system. Now, I was asked, one of you asked me, so what do you do about this when you have proven that the basic theory is wrong? You continue to do calculations. You got a job. You have a career. Most of the time, you just go on and do the same thing more. Furthermore, proofs are fallible. We have been all talking, and you probably have also, about the Italian proof that special relativity is wrong. There will be only maybe a dozen people in the world, maybe three of them here, who will change their research because of that proof that special relativity is wrong. Most of the rest of us will go on and assume that that proof is either incorrect or somehow can be explained. Next bunch of stuff is somehow explained, is in the category of somehow explained. So statistical mechanics fails in this boiling region. Here, the finite size of real systems produces a tiny, unobservable, usually, rounding of this sharp corner. And here, there is an observable effect in which very large systems you can, in which even in very large systems, you can see something about the finite coherence length. So the modern view is that we understand more or less what's going on, and some of what is going on is an idealization to what happens in an infinite system. Mean field theory contains no such idealization. Let me, in fact, give you a proof that mean field theory contains no such idealization. Lights up. I pushed the wrong button. Cancel. Right button. Put my glasses on, I'll get the right button. Okay. That's fine. I got another board there. Imagine that I had a ring like this, and the van der Waals theory would work perfectly well on such a ring. Everybody except the guy at the edges would have the right number of nearest neighbors. The guys at the edges would still have enough nearest neighbors so that you would have them aligned with everything. And you would then, in this system, conclude from mean field theory that the mean field theory would predict a phase transition. In fact, you do not get a sharp phase transition in any finite system. Now, there are additional hints that mean field theory is not so wonderfully great. Those hints are in the detailed measurement of what happens in the neighborhood of the critical point. We've already talked about those things. They're what are called critical indices, which describe how different things, like the compressibility, the coherence length, the jump in density, and the dependence of the density on pressure temperature equal to the critical temperature, how these things depend on the variables in the system. These are dependences on temperature minus critical temperature, and here is a dependence on pressure minus critical pressure, or on magnetic field, depending on whether you're in a liquid or a magnet. Mean field theory gives values of the indices here, for all kinds of systems. We have an exact solution of the two-dimensional Ising model due to Ansager, and we have series and other methods, including experiment, to study three-dimensional systems. These are the sorts of numbers that come out. These numbers are different from these numbers, and this gives us a hint. Well, for example, a beta, which describes the jump in density as it goes to zero at the critical temperature, is 1/2 in the theory. In Andrew's experiment, it was closer to 1/3. And in the two-dimensional Ising model, according to a calculation of Yang, it is exactly 1/8. Okay. Mean field theory is useless in predicting phase transitions and ordering over long distances. It predicts phase transitions predicts phase transitions in one-dimensional systems with finite range interactions at non-zero temperatures. It would predict a phase transition in the one-dimensional Ising model. As we've seen, this phase transition does not occur. There are three models which serve as a good test of what one is doing. You have an Ising model in which the magnetization can point in one of two directions. You have an XY model in which the magnetization can point in any direction in the plane. And you have what might be called an XYZ model, except that it's called the Heisenberg model, in which the magnetization can point in any direction in three-dimensional space. These have different behaviors in two dimensions. In the Ising model, there is a phase transition, and you get a long-range order. The spins are ordered over long distances. In the XY model, you get a phase transition, but no long-range order. Or if you look far away, the ordering has died out. And the Heisenberg model, there is no phase transition. Mean field theory says that they're all the same, that there's a phase transition in each and every one of them. I'm just bringing you evidence that mean field theory is wrong. Another piece of evidence is that mean field theory predicts a specific heat that looks like this, that jumps at the critical temperature and has some smooth behavior away from that. Here is the experiment, Moldover and Little. They looked at phase transitions, liquid gas phase transition in Bose helium 4 here, Bose helium, in Fermi helium, that's helium 3, and the superfluid transition of helium. They got things which showed clear indications that the specific heat was going to infinity, and mean field theory predicts that. Evidence is piling up. I'll tell you a little bit about what does the story. The fluctuations in the order parameter, the production of large-scale drops, produces the behavior near the critical point, and those large-scale drops are not described very well by the mean field theory. Now, for some reason, I don't have it up as a slide, but I should tell you what was going on. So in 1937, the gurus in the field learned that there was something seriously wrong. In 1870, Van der Waals knew that there was something seriously wrong. However, there was hope springs eternal, and various people nonetheless continued to hope that you would get that the mean field theory would give you a result which was essentially correct. In fact, as I entered the field, Uhlenbeck, a tremendously impressive lecturer, was saying that the major problem in the field was to prove more accurately that the van der Waals theory was correct. However, looking back from the historical perspective, the major problem is to devise a theory which can replace the van der Waals theory. In 1937, people could ignore the failures of the van der Waals theory because there was nothing else around. Gradually, step by step, I'm going to tell you how it happened, replacement came into being. And as it developed, the gurus in the field were very happy to accept it. With a few exceptions, but not many. And it caught on very nicely. Now, some people say that the big nail in the coffin of the van der Waals theory was the Ansager theory, which gave results that don't agree with the mean field theory in two dimensions. Other people say that the nails in the coffin of the theory were the various experiments, like the Moldova little specific heat experiment that I showed you, or I'm blowing on the name of the Russian guy who did the analogous thing first. That's always happens. It'll come to me. In any case, there were a bunch of experiments. More and more of those experiments were showing that the mean field theory gave bad results. It's also true that the King's College School, that is Cyril Dome, Martin Sykes, Michael Fisher, and other people, were doing expansions like the ones we talked about for high temperatures and low temperatures, and they were calculating critical indices and finding values that did not agree with mean field theory. So now I'm going to tell you how the new replacement theory developed. We have a situation in which it is clear to many people that a replacement theory is going to be needed. That doesn't mean that the people will stop working on the old theory, physics goes on, but they will feel more and more uncomfortable about the old theory. And then in 1964, not that one, what about this one? Okay, I got it, I guess. In 1964, Ben Whittam suggests a phenomenology. Nomenology, approximately right. A phenomenology, that is a putting together of the facts which suggests how a theory might develop. Ben notices, he works in fluid stuff. I always found fluid stuff harder than magnetic stuff, so I'm going to express things in the magnetic language. We had difficulties communicating with each other because of this essentially trivial problem. But in any case, the order parameter goes as temperature minus critical temperature to the power beta. And there's a constant of proportionality in there, which I'm not going to write. This is what is true for magnetic field equal to zero. The magnetization goes like H to the 1 over delta at T equals zero as a function of magnetic field. Whittam has the piece of insight to say, let's assume that the thing goes like T to the beta times some function of T over H to a power. And you can see that the effect of T to the beta is of the same order as the effect of h to the 1 over delta. So let's guess that the function is of the form minus t to the beta over h to the 1 over delta. That is, these things are both going to be very small. We're going to be looking in the limit as these things go to 0. And the only way we can measure them is against one another. The magnetization tells us, according to Whittam, how we can measure them. Let us make this guess. Guess maybe is an impolite word. When I was describing it later on, I called it an assertion. This is a big deal because it enables us to say something like, the minus beta H is the number of particles, say, in the Ising system, times the free energy per particle. Let me use the symbol G for the free energy per particle. G can be expressed in similar language. If G starts out as T to the 2 minus alpha, that will give you the right index. Oh, we haven't talked about alpha. The specific heat is said to be proportional to T to the minus alpha. The specific heat diverges. Alpha is a small number. The present number is of the order of 0.06 or 0.03. I can't remember exactly what it is for the liquid gas phase transition, but it's a small number. This alpha appearing there will, after two derivatives, reappear as a t to the minus alpha. And so this is a phenomenologically correct statement. And why don't we make the statement that this is some function? What do you call a function? G, H, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q. Some function, Q, of the same kind of thing, minus t to the beta over h to the 1 over delta. And that's really bingo. That's really great, because we now can calculate everything by differentiating this free energy per particle with respect to things. For example, we could differentiate it with respect to the magnetic field and get the magnetization out, for example. So Whittam develops a magic formula giving all critical indices in terms of two of them. Starting out with the, well, there are three in this formula, but since this formula predicts both beta and delta, there are only two left. And so Whittam then presents a point of view which enables you to calculate all of the critical indices as functions of precisely two of them. Yes?
When we write t equals 0 in that equation.
Let me remember how you do it. It's not entirely unsophisticated what you do. Let's get the magnetization out, since this is not a colloquium. Come on, go on. Okay, I'm going to show you, or unless I have very bad luck, I will show you how to get the magnetization out. The magnetization is the derivative of the free energy with respect to the magnetic field. G is defined here. It is the free energy per particle. I made the bad mistake of using F here, and then I couldn't put an F there, which is what I would naturally have wanted to do. And so I got stuck at this stage in which I had to use Q, which has never before been used for this quantity. My apologies for not doing the elegant thing. That's what happens when you think you know a subject and try to ad lib. You know it well enough for some purposes, but not others. Lights on. There we go. So sigma is minus t to the 2 minus alpha times this function q of, now which way did I put it? I said it was q of minus t to the beta times divided by h to the 1 over delta. So I differentiate this whole mess equals minus t to the 2 minus alpha. Q prime of the same set of variables. Minus t to the beta. H to the 1 over delta plus 1. Times a factor of 1 over delta times a minus sign. That's what the derivative is. And here's a minus t to the beta and an h to the 1 over delta. Now, that doesn't look like this. Or this. But let's make a demand which will probably give us what we want. Let's let h go to 0, for example. If h goes to 0, we can say that this argument goes to very large values. We could then demand that as the argument goes to very large values, it cancels out this h to the 1 over delta plus 1. That tells us what happens to this argument at very large values. That will leave us with some power of t. That we then write out that power, and we say that that is what is conventionally called beta. And that gives us the formula we want. Yes? The other thing that we know is that the free energy is extensive. That it has a factor of n in it. What we knew was this 2 minus alpha. This is the result that we get in one limit of this argument. In fact, the statement is that as h goes to 0, this argument, which goes to infinity, goes to infinity, and then we say the q of infinity is some constant. That gives the 2 minus alpha as the correct power of t in the limit as h goes to 0. We don't have to make this, well, we do have to, but imagine I had made this thing, I had said I need blackboard. We'll take blackboard over that side so I can see what I'm doing from there at the same time. And I need an eraser. It's amusing how the elegant people who designed this room missed up on something. Yeah. They did such an elegant job on so many other things, and then misunderstood something trivial. Okay. So we start out with a formula that the free energy per particle is t to the 2 minus alpha times some function of minus t to the beta divided by h to the 1 over delta. As h goes to 0, let me demand that q, that's as x goes to infinity, the q of x goes as x to the power lambda. Then I get g is t. Actually, I put in a minus, but because I was thinking about below critical temperature. We then get minus t to the beta over h to the 1 over delta to the power lambda. There is one and only one possible value of lambda that will give us a result as h goes to 0, which is only a function of t. That demands that lambda equals 0. So we know that g goes as t to the 2 minus alpha as h goes to 0. And we know something about the behavior of q. We go through the same game here only a little bit more complicated with Q prime, and it gives us a value of beta, both in the limit in which h goes to 0 and gives us the value of delta in the limit in which t goes to 0. That then gives us a full description of the magnetization. The crucial thing that you see, that you recognize here, is that you can see, you can describe the asymptotic behavior of these functions from the known asymptotic behavior of the free energy. And that gives you, for example, this result that as x goes to infinity, if q of x goes as x to the lambda, that lambda must be 0. It is, how do I say it? There are games to play with it. It's something that you do, so pretty soon it becomes mechanical. Pretty soon you can mechanically define all of the values of the indices from this. For example, here it is obviously clear that we want, as h goes to 0, we want f, which is as the argument goes to infinity, we want f to go to a constant. That is, we want it to go to one constant for t greater than 0, and another constant for t less than 0. The t greater than 0 case is above the critical temperature. We want that constant to be equal to 0 for above the critical temperature. And so the summary of what is happening is that Widom gives us all from 2. Or another way of saying it is that one function, this function, describes the whole critical behavior. And the insight that you get comes from the view that the only way you can measure the size of the difference in temperature from the critical point is against the magnetic field value. Or if you had a finite size system, you can measure the deviation of the temperature from criticality against this 1 over the size of the system. So Widom gives us a big deal phenomenology, which enables us to understand in a qualitative way what is going on near the phase transition. It more or less says that here. I hadn't put together this lecture properly until last night, so the notes don't include this. This is the same thing in a different ordering. This is the free energy as a function of temperature and magnetic field. It goes with some power of h over t to the capital delta, and capital delta is then, as an equivalent representation, is h to the 1 over small beta times small delta. Same story. Widom then gives us a bunch of magic relations among the critical indices, expressing all of them in terms of 2. I've left out a piece, and I shouldn't leave out a piece. So I'll unleave out that piece in a moment. So we turn on the lights. Pokrovsky and Pradashinsky, two young scientists literally in Siberia. They weren't, actually, they somewhat like Siberia. They're not there as punishments. They like their hometown of Novosibirsk. These guys are looking at the behavior of fluctuations in things like the magnetization. They start from the fact that this is known to be some power, which I'm going to be calling 2x. Nah, I'll call it 2y. 2y of r minus s. They then interpret this statement as a statement that sigma r looks like 1 over r to the some power. What that means is that if you're looking at a distance scale r, and this must apply when r minus s is much bigger than a lattice constant and is much smaller than the size of the system, what Pokrovsky and Patashinsky suggest is that there is a characteristic size that goes with how the magnetization depends. Well, I don't think I want an expectation value. How the magnetization depends on the length scale. That is like Whittam's argument about characteristic sizes here, but it is applying to something else. And indeed, the Pokrovsky and Patashinsky result is a result which is extended to having a sigma at position one and another one at position two, up to n of these guys. They say that if the distances between Rj and Rk are all of order L, all of order R, then this goes is proportional to 1 over r to the power n, one for each one of these guys, y, a critical index that goes with y. So what is being developed here is a point of view that has to do with scaling. That has to do with the sizes of things near the critical point, in the limit L goes to infinity, in which the critical behavior is most manifest, there is no natural length scale, no natural scale of anything. You measure the size of H versus the size of temperature, but not versus T precisely. You measure the size of these things as against powers of one another. That is, in fact, you're measuring H against T to the beta times delta. You're measuring the magnetization, for example, as R to the minus Y. You're expecting, because there's no natural scale of things, to have everything be a power law. And in this period between 1964 and 1966, a phenomenological theory develops, only known by a few people, but a theory develops which enables people to, if they think about it, to see how relative sizes of things work. One more step in this direction is that I did sort of analogous to this, sigma r times sigma s, the correlation function analysis, as r minus s goes to infinity. I found a behavior which included a factor of e to the minus r minus s divided by a coherence length. And here comes the important result. The coherence length I found went as a over the temperature minus the critical temperature when H equals zero. So people were beginning to acquire knowledge, fragments of knowledge, tiny bits of knowledge None of that stuff fits in with mean field theory, and none of that stuff then can be explained exactly. Now comes a next step in the development of the phenomenological theory, which I'm going to tell you about now. What we found was that this coherence length went as 1 over temperature to the 1/2 in mean field theory, went as 1 as e to the 2k in one-dimensional Ising model as k went to infinity. And in fact, it goes as 1 over t to the 0.63 power, I won't promise you the 3, in the three-dimensional Ising magnet or fluid. Not all kinds of magnets, single-axis magnet. That's a summary of what has appeared so far in the course. In fact, this is what I just told you is something slightly new for us in the course, and was accepted in the field, but should have been accepted with more comment. What I told you about how things go with powers goes with the word scaling. Things behave as powers. That's described in the word scaling. There's also another word, which is universality. That says that different things show the same behavior. As we look at large length scales. What this says in the limit of which we get close to criticality, so we're looking at large length scales, the three-dimensional Ising model and a three-dimensional single axis ferromagnet, that is a real material, or a fluid, will all have the same value of the coherence length. It will all go as some constant, that constant being material dependent, divided by t minus tc to some power, and that power will be the same for all of these cases. That's what you mean by universality. Different things are the same. Now, physicists love universality. Chemists like things to be different so they can talk about the diversity of nature. Physicists love universality, but you gotta look for it carefully. What we're beginning to see empirically is universality near the critical point. It was first developed by the King's College School, who, as you recall, did series expansions and used them to determine critical indices. They wrote down carefully in their papers that this one series expansion was for a simple cubic lattice and another was for a face-centered cubic lattice, but they got and expected essentially the same results for all kinds of lattices. The result depends on dimension, as you can see there, but doesn't depend upon exact details of the system. That's universality and something that physicists love to find. In fact, there's a long history of universality in discussions of fluids, some of it slightly embarrassing. Going back to Einstein, not everything Einstein did was perfect. Going back to Einstein, people looked for and developed theories in which all fluids would show the same phase diagram. Now, that's nonsense. All fluids do not show the same phase diagram. And in fact, the details of the phase diagram depends on the details of the intermolecular interaction, as you can just tell by looking at the first couple of terms in a power series expansion in the interactions. Wise people followed up that point of view long beyond the place at which it seemed would have seemed reasonable to us to follow it. Uhlenbeck, I should say that Uhlenbeck and I never got along terribly well. Uhlenbeck followed that point of view incorrectly to the end of his life. Einstein followed it for a few years. A man by the name of Guggenheim, an important physical chemist, followed that point of view. Each and every one of them were looking for a universality in the full phase diagram of fluids. That's not there. Landau suggested that there was a universality near the critical point. That is, Landau's expansion in magnetization, magnetization squared, magnetization to the fourth power, etc. Landau's expansion probably works best near the critical point, or might be expected to work best near the critical point. And so we might have expected something from his analysis, which was universal, to get universal results. However, Landau's results are not correct. They had the right universality properties, but the wrong details. So now another important event in this period is that there was a conference organized by what is called the National Bureau of Standards, was called the National Bureau of Standards of the United States, in which experimentalists working on the critical region, theorists working on that, came together, a conference on critical phenomena in the year 1966. This conference had the important result that all of these guys put together their results, and they saw that there was something interesting going on at the critical point, and that that something interesting could not be described by mean field theory. They were not directly informed about the new theoretical stuff. Bukrovsky and Patashinsky were stuck in Siberia. Ben Whittem was stuck in Ithaca, New York, which is almost as hard to get out of as Siberia. And they didn't come to the conference. So the conference had the best of experimental things, but didn't have a tremendous amount of theoretical stuff. Nonetheless, the conference was suggested that people should be ready for something new in the description of what was going on near the critical point. The next step in the development of a phenomenology is something that I relate closely to because it's mine. And when I get the lights set up properly, I will tell you a little bit about it, and then we will finish it up next time. Can you see the gray arrow behind the black arrow there? Hard to see. Okay. The answer is either yes or no. Can you see it? Okay, fine. I suggested a point of view in which one would take a lattice. I draw it and drew it then as two dimensions, but it's clear that something similar would work in three. Divide it into boxes. This has 9 spins across. I divided it into boxes, three by three boxes, and then you see that there are nine of such big boxes. And each box, I said, let us describe each box by the average spin in that box. In fact, I will use a variable which points up when the average spin is up and points down when the average spin is down. I will then, fixing the values of these lumped variables in the words of used before to describe Schwinger's work, fixing the value of these variables which describe the blocks, I will then sum over the individual Ising variables and form a partition function which has the same physics in it, but is now described in terms of these lumped variables. That then reflects the point of view on scaling. What we are looking at is a description of the same problem on a different scale. This is all familiar to you now. It's become commonplace discussion. It was not so tremendously original in some sense at that time. You talk about it, you've talked about how this coupling constants in field theories vary as you vary the energy scale. You talk about running coupling constants. I think you've talked about running coupling constants, haven't you? No? Okay. Yes or no, or maybe. Okay. I will talk about running coupling constants. I'll just spend a moment. So we have length scales. We've got the length scale of the Large Hadron Collider, and we have the length scale of of which we believe the basic theories work, and they're tremendously different length scales. And what we want to do is derive a theory. And what we do is derive a theory in which things like the coupling constants, alpha, not fixed at 1 over 137. You know alpha. You know what alpha is. Yes, OK. Which things like alpha, not fixed at a value of 1 over 137, but vary as a function of size within the system. This, too, goes under the name of scaling. At this moment, when I've talked for an hour and a half, I find myself unable to exactly tell you who was exactly what the words are. Nope, I can't. Gell-Mann two N's, no one N. And Lowe, Murray Gell-Mann, Francis Lowe, in the late 1950s. 1950 big, some late 1950s. Talked about how you might do things like this in quantum electrodynamics, and did something which they called renormalization group and became called the renormalization group, which had some of this content. You would change the value of things depending on the energy scale. And for example, alpha might be believed to go as alpha naught divided by the logarithm of the energy scale of E naught divided by the energy scale. So they slowly, slowly varied with energy. This kind of scaling of the coupling constants with distance was talked about and was among many discussions of lumped variables, a variable that you might use to describe what is going on in a whole region. So next time, What we're going to do is put together a formalism which enables you to represent what goes on inside of this block by a single variable, that enables you to represent the Ising model on a big system by Ising models with a smaller number of variables that nonetheless have the same physical content as the big system, and thereby enable you to understand scaling as it arises in the near critical system. It will have as a extra bonus that universality will fall out for free near the critical point. But that's for next time. We're going to describe the phenomenological theory of renormalization depicted there, and the improvements on that theory by Ken Wilson, which will give us today's renormalization theory. Questions, comments? Okay.